You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 160.
To be a filmmaker, you have to lead. Danny Boyle.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari.
Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Now, guys, how many filmmakers out there listening not only want to get their independent films made, but how many of you would like to have that film picked up by HBO Max and given a major release on that platform? Well, today's guest did exactly that. We have writer-director Lisette Feliciano, and she wrote and directed the film Women Is Losers, which premiered at the South by Southwest Film Festival in 2021. And I wanted to have Lisette on the show to, first of all, find out how she was able to get a little independent film made, first of all, with the cast that she was able to get, and basically doing it on a very low budget. And from there, how she was able to get to HBO Max and that whole process. And there is a lot of ups and downs. It took years before this project could get off the ground. And Lisette did not stop. We talk a lot about her journey, how many times she thought she was just going to give up on this dream, and so much more. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Lisette Feliciano.
Button again. All right. Three. Two, one. I'd like to welcome to the show Lisette Feliciano. How are you doing, Lisette?
Hi, I'm good. How are you, Alex?
I'm doing very good. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm excited to get into, because you have had obviously you just made it overnight. I mean, you just started this yesterday, and you just automatically just got the first movie done, and it was like it happened like within 2-3 months, right? It's something like that, right?
Oh yeah, super easy, super easy. I woke up one day, I was like, I'm gonna be a director, and then it happened.
It just happened, right? And then the money just starts piling in. They bring the truckloads of cash, and they just dump it. So, it's something like that's the way it works, isn't it?
Totally. I don't know where to put all of it. We're swimming in it like this.
It's like a scene it's like a scene from Narcos. Like, I've got too much cash, man. I can't hide.
But yeah, no, I'm moving into the house from Casino very soon.
Very nice. Very well played. Well played. No, I wanted to have you on the show because you've had a journey, to say the least, on getting your first film made. So let's start from the beginning. How did you get started in this business, and why did you want to get into this crazy business?
Dude, I ask myself that all the time.
Right?
Thank you. Yeah, man, crazy around the globe, circle to get to this point. I grew up in the Mission District of San Francisco. I don't know if your audience is pretty familiar, but, it's basically the Latino area of San Francisco. Now it's the tech area. My neighbor is, good old Facebook, which has been fun. So it's been cool to see it, change. in a weird way. But yes, I went there and I was this guy, you know, I wrote a lot as a kid because it was just like something that I could do that would kind of keep me busy. And there was a lot going on at home, as some of your, as your audience will know, because the movie is based on my family. So, mm-hmm. you know, a lot about me based on how I grew up and in and around that, that situation. And I was just, I realized that like, I liked writing and people liked reading it. So, you know, I wrote myself into a better high school, and then I somehow wrote myself into NYU. Had no idea what the hell NYU was. True story, we had a guidance counselor who got money together, pooled money together to take girls on college tours because mm-hmm. we couldn't, that was too cost prohibitive for us. We'd, all of us were going to local schools. She's like, why aren't you guys even trying for Harvard? And we're like, first of all, what the hell is Harvard? And second of all, where's Boston? Like, we just, these things that like now seem crazy, but I had no idea.
Sure.
So I went into NYU, just shocked everybody, shocked myself. I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And went there and very quickly learned that filmmaking was a really cool way to put writing and acting and theater all together, and that you could pack it into a digital file and send it to loads of people who couldn't come to your, like, your local theater. So anyway, so I went there, and then I decided, okay, I'm going to go out to Hollywood and I'm going to be a director, right? That's what I studied. And
You study directing, you go to Hollywood because that's where the directors get jobs.
Exactly.
And that's where they make movies, so I'll just get there and get my first job. And I'll just knock on a couple doors and it should be fine.
So fine. not fine at all. This was 2012. And I don't know if people really remember this, but like it was 4 years before Me Too, 4 years before BLM. And even those 4 years were so different. Like the shift of being like, I'm a female director, I'm also Latina and, US born Latina, but nonetheless, like, that was like not even a thought in anybody's mind that that could be something available to me. And then Me Too happened and BLM happened and it started becoming like, oh no, but we need this. So I'm definitely a beneficiary of how the industry has shifted, even in the last decade that I've been in it. So, anyways, I came out here, started PAing. I think my first job was like picking up trash in like Selena Gomez's, trailer. I was like her hand double on some things with Tiny Movie. It was insane. Working 22 hours a day,
yeah.
No breaks, nothing, minimum, like stand with IATSE guys. And yeah, it just wasn't, you know, I kept making writing and kept making proof of concepts and just doing everything I could to say, I'm a writer, I'm a director, I'm going to do these things. And, you know, had a couple of projects like not go or go. And I just kind of mm-hmm. noticed that after a while, it was less about my experience and more about it me being me that was coming into the room. Mm-hmm. So, and it wasn't like anybody, and you probably know this, but people don't actually say that you can't do something. They never, like, there's no evil person in the room going, that doesn't happen. It's just, they don't say anything. It's just very quiet, right? It's like, and then they kind of laugh a little, like smile a little, like, oh, you're so ambitious. Good for you.
You've got spunk, kid. You're a spark plug.
You've got spunk. You're sparky. You know, like, keep going. It's going to be great for you. But then there's no actual help or support.
Right.
And so I'd gone through that process twice. And then by the third one, by the time Women as Losers came around, I was like, I can't go through that process again. I'm just going to do this for myself at this point. And by that time I'd produced some commercials that made a little bit of money in my production company and was able to, you know, co-finance and get here. So it really was a bootstrap mentality all the way.
And you went into commercials as well.
I did. Yeah. Cause it was crazy, Alex. Like people would give me millions of dollars to produce a commercial. I'm not great at spreadsheets. I'm terrible at spreadsheets. But for some reason, the mentality that I could produce was just like a given. But then the second I wanted to direct, it was like, whoa.
Yeah.
What do you mean? Do you know where to point the camera? I was like, yeah, dude, trust me. I know where to point the camera more than I do where to put the spreadsheet. Trust. But, you know, it was just about taking my disadvantages and making them into my own advantages.
Yeah, no question. I mean, I literally felt the same exact. I, when I was coming up, I was doing commercial works as well in Miami. And I remember like my reps were saying, hey, if you do a Spanish commercial, you're done. Like I couldn't do a Latino commercial because if anyone finds out in the general market that you did a Latino commercial, they just won't let you do general market commercials because you can't. I'm like, but the lights are the same. People, I mean, the camera, the lens hasn't changed. Why? Because you're speaking a different language. And that was the mentality back in the 90s, you know, when I was coming up. It was crazy. So I understand that, you know, it was a crazy time. But yeah, so you get into commercials, which I feel is a great proving ground for a director.
Yeah.
I mean, Ridley and Tony were the ones that kind of broke the door open. And then, I mean, the plethora of directors that came from the commercial world was great. So, all right. So then you write the script for Women is Losers. How do you begin to get something like this made? Because it's not like, obviously, this is going to make a boatload of cash. So let's throw as much money at this as we can. Like, how did you approach this?
It was just that it was a decision. I'm going to do this. I don't know at what scale I'm going to do it, but in a year, this film will be done. And it really was just that decision. And then I think that decision kind of pushed forward there just wasn't an option to not do it anymore. And I wasn't going to wait anymore. I wasn't going to wait to be given permission. I wasn't going to wait for somebody to see the potential in me. It just wasn't going to happen. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I started very small. And then I went out to talent first, an amazing casting director. And, you know, very quickly we found Lorenza. And I think once Lorenza came on board, it just started clicking for people. They're like, oh, I see, Celine. I see what you're trying to do here. I kind of go from there. We'd also had a short film prior to this. Like, so I had done a short film about it. It was like my fifth short film. And I'd done a short film. And, you know, like most of the times in short films, nobody comes up and talks to you. You're kind of like the opening previews for something else. This time, though, people wanted to talk to me. They wanted to say, what happens next? Or they wanted to tell me that they were Selena, or they were, sorry.
So good. Okay.
my dog. Hey. Sorry.
It happens. It happens.
Yeah. Give me one second. Sure. So they wanted to tell me that, like, oh, it's that's me, that's my sister, that's like everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, okay, this hit a nerve, and I was like, okay, let me think about that going forward. And I think a year later, I decided to make it into a feature length because so many people had been like, I want to see more of this. And I was like, all right, let me just follow the market here. And yeah, mm-hmm. That's how it kind of came to life.
Now the movie, it's beautifully shot. I mean, it is a film that is a period piece. So there, you know, you could only make it so much harder on yourself as a first time feature director. Oh, let's do a period piece. Let's do it about this subject and that, you know, so it's a lot of obstacles, but it looks great. How did you raise the financing for this? And how did you, cause this was not like HBO wrote you a check and like, listen, just go do your thing, girl. Like that wasn't the case.
No way at all. It was more about like finding something. The financing, it's always tough, right? I think for your first movie, there's this myth that someone's going to come and give you however much money to do something. And I just like, that just hasn't been the case for like me or any of the directors that I know. It was always something about them scraping together whatever they had to make it work. And the people that I saw do that successfully were the ones that not only embraced their budgetary concerns, but used it as part of the story. Chloe Zhao being the most famous example of that. Mm-hmm. So the financing was just kind of a little bit of everything. It was what I had saved from work. It'd been a couple of different people that were, you know, giving a small amount or a big amount and really writing that into the script. So yes, I wanted to make a period piece as my first movie, which people were like, you're insane. I was like, I don't care. They kept telling me, make your one room movie. I was like, a one room movie and a period piece, they're hard. Either any movie is hard to make. And I just didn't want, it just kept being like, I kept being asked to play small. And I was like, look, I'm creative. I can find a way to work this in, to work this disadvantage into the story, because the story is about a woman doing that, right? It's very meta. Like what she was going through in the scenes is what I was going through behind the scenes. And the cast to their credit, like a lot of them felt the same way, like being Selena. everybody that came to the story, from Brian Craig to Chrissy Fitt to Simu Liu to Lorenza, they all had a version of the story for themselves, about what it's like to make, you know, make gold out of lead, essentially.
alchemy, essentially.
Definitely some alchemy there.
Now, what inspired you to write this in the first place?
My mom. My mom. I had a conversation with her around the time that I was making the short film, because I had done all the steps that people had told me to do. Do this and then this will happen. Do this and this and then this will happen. But every time I got to that step, it felt like the goalpost kept moving. So I obviously internalized that and said, well, that's because I'm just not that good. That's what's happening. Like, I'm not that talented. And I had to go and tell my mom this, that I failed, essentially. I was like, I'm sorry that we spent all this money and all this time going after this dream. It's not working. And I'm sorry. And I'm ready to let it go. And you know, we'll figure it out. And she was like, no, that's not what's happening. This is what's happening to you. And for the first time in our life, she told me everything that happened to her in the 70s. And showed me receipts, Alex. She showed me a receipt. She showed me a letter from her boss saying, congratulations on the birth of your son. Your 2 weeks vacation is over. Time to come back to work. Like, she had a C-section, you know? So, like, there's things that I had no idea about that were, like, real for women of the time period. And that she had lived through this. So I just saw some similarities in between what was happening to her, what's happening to me. And I wanted to create a story that celebrated that. Like, you know, you're all looking for your superhero movie, but it turns out my superhero was right under my feet the whole time.
Oh, that's great. That's so amazing. Because we all need champions. Because the struggle is real. There's no question about it. And as filmmakers, especially after a certain amount of time, you're just like, is it me? Am I not good enough? Am I not, like, what? Because you're right. Like, so many of us go through this process of, like, I did this, but the goalpost just keeps moving or the doors don't open. And I've always found, and after interviewing as many people as I've interviewed on the show, I found that it's only when you start touching something that is true to you, it's a story that you can't, that no one else can tell but you, that's when doors start opening up, because that's the secret sauce. That is your secret sauce. Like, I can't tell your story. You can't tell my story. It is something so specific to us. So I think if filmmakers start to find that thing inside them and not be afraid, because a lot of people would be terrified to put your film out there and that script out there. It is pretty personal, to say the least.
Yeah. Which part? You're so right. It was just about, like, coming in to that piece of saying, who am I? What do I want to be saying? And being really vulnerable. Like, it was really scary. I don't think it really hit me until, like, South By happened. Like, the night before South By, I was like, oh my God, what did I do? Everybody's going to see this. There's no way to get this back. And just being really, you know, like, I'm putting my grandma out there, my grandfather, my mother, my brother, myself, in a very, like, vulnerable way. And you're right. For some reason, that's the one that always it hits, because everybody kind of feels that way. It seems like, you know, it's just everyone has felt vulnerable, has felt like, I know what it's like to struggle to put food on the table. And that's not, like, that's not gender or culture specific. That's everybody.
I don't think there's only a handful of human beings on the planet who have had the luxury of never having to worry about that. And struggling, you know, I mean, I came from a middle to lower middle class, you know, growing up in New York and Miami and all these kind of places. So I completely feel it. And I was, I'm a bit older than you. So I was around in the 70s. I was a kid in the 70s, but I still remember it. Mm. And I remember what my mom would go through. And I was raised by basically a single mom. So I get it. Now, the other thing, you got an amazing cast. How did you gather this amazing cast with you know, being a first time director, which is always that thing to, like, oh, let's stop for a second. The first time director bullshit. It just drove me nuts. You know, when I was a first, how much of this, oh, well, you've done a few shorts. Oh, you've done $1 million commercials. But yet, I don't know if you really can hold this for 90 minutes. How often did you hit that first time director wall?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Every single step of the way. Every single step of the way. It got comical to a point. And what right? helped, it was just, and even now, like I'm doing TV now and it's like, well, you've never directed an episode of TV. And I'm like, oh my God, you guys, I can't go through this again. Like, it's like, it's going to be fine. I promise. It's going to be okay. But you know, I can't explain it. There's like this real fear of, and more fear for certain people, I think, just because, again, the lack of perceived potential that comes with how we as a human race have associated authority, right? The way the symbol for authority does not look like me. Mm-hmm. And on a set, you are the symbol of authority. So there's a lot of things that we're dealing with subconsciously that I don't think a lot of people are realizing. Sorry if you can hear.
Yeah, it's all good. It's all good. So yeah, no, you're absolutely right. There is a subconscious, you know, a subconscious thing going on, and you know, it's something that people have to deal with, unfortunately. But I think the doors have been opening a lot more in the last 5 years than they have been in the last 50.
Yeah, absolutely. And thankfully so. I'm going to move because it's just very loud.
Sure.
Thankfully so. Sorry, there's like 2-year-olds.
Hey, I completely understand.
Yeah, thankfully that's been a big part of it. That things have been changing. And I'm definitely a beneficiary of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, again, so let's go back to that amazing cast. How did you gather them, and how did you, you know, did you have to deal with the first time director stuff with the cast, and did you have because a lot of filmmakers tell me, and I know this to be a fact, is when you're going to casting, they always want to see verifiable funds, and you know, is this really going to happen, and who are you? You've never done anything. Like when you're talking to agents and managers and even casting people, how did you go through all that? Because you have a pretty amazing cast.
Yeah. Well, I think it's the type of casting that we did, right? Like if somebody was going to have those concerns off the bat, then they probably weren't going to be the team players that we needed. So Lorenza Issa is a perfect example of that, because she not only came to the story pre-financing, basically, she came to the story and she said, I want to be an EP. So that to me signified two things. It signified to me she was brave, and it signified to me that she was a team player. All the things that were necessary on the camera and behind the camera. Same thing with Brian Craig. He came on, he had 3 days before we were shooting. His first scene was the opening scene, Alex. And mm-hmm. he was just off book. And I called him and I said, I need you to play a guy that is going to help young guys make the jump from what kind of guy do I want to be? You have to be able to give them space to ask themselves that question non-judgmentally. Are you open to that? And he was like, I'm in. That was it, right? Similarly, the same thing. It was, here's a conversation about representation that hasn't happened. And the similarities between the struggle that the Chinese American community went through, the Latino American community is going through now. Like, can you bridge that gap down, right? So that was the type of casting that I did, because they're all great actors. You don't, at that point, like there's not one person that's coming into the room that doesn't know how to act. But for me, it's about the core connection. And to this day, right? Like even the new projects that we're working on, what's the core connection? Because that's what's going to carry it through. And so I think having those conversations was what was able to solidify this cast. And they're just great. They're just great people all across the board.
Now, as directors, there's always that moment where you're on set and something happens where your entire world comes crashing down around you. And it's either you're losing the sun, the first AD is not, you're not making your day, an actor's not doing something, the location is lost, the camera gets thrown into a lake, whatever that moment is. What was that moment for you on this project, and how did you overcome it?
Every day.
I was terrified every single day. No.
every day. Okay, Blabbermouth, come here. He just wants to be a part of this conversation.
Sure.
We were shooting on location in San Francisco. That was very important to me because I was tired of seeing San Francisco depicted as Golden Gate and cable cars because I grew up poor in San Francisco. If you grow up poor in San Francisco, you're going to a bodega and maybe you go to the Golden Gate Bridge on a field trip that your pastor put together. Like, that's just the reality of that world.
Right.
So I was like, I'm going to shoot in San Francisco, and it's home team advantage, obviously.
Sure.
Like, high school is my high school, so I had home team advantage. The downside of that is that it's very expensive to shoot in San Francisco. And I do have to give it to the SF Film Commission because they helped a ton. But it's just not fully a city that's set up yet for infrastructure of film. Changing, definitely changing. But we had to move locations every day. So like every day we moved 2-3 times a day. So I got maybe 6 to 8 hours of camera time. 6 to 8 hours at best. So there's some wonders in there, Alex, that like I didn't plan for. But we're just like, okay. What do I have to say? And I have 30 minutes to say it. So sure. I think that was definitely the moments where we were just like, oh my, like that opening scene.
Yeah.
That opening scene we shot in 6 hours. And then we had to go shoot the hospital scenes. The dance scene we shot, the dance scene and everything around it, all the conversations, one night. Like we were literally in the school overnight and then had to get out of there by 7 a.m. because we were leaving and the girls were coming in for class.
Sure.
You know, so that there's definitely moments where you're just like, okay, great. How do I zone this? How do I, and I'm telling you, like the cast were so good because they were such team players in terms of production as well, right? There are things where I was just like, you just need to stand here and say this line and it will work. I promise. And they really gave me that trust. So it did help in that as I'd had a lot of experience working outside of America. In places with much less infrastructure like Brazil and Ghana. And so being able to think faster on feet, and my DP for Hadamen Dehelvey, which you guys, he's the best, biggest thing coming into the cinematography space. He's worked a lot in India. So like we were both very fast on our feet. And that I think helped us a ton on this show.
Do you pretty much, I think the one word that encompasses what we do as directors is compromise. It's just compromise. Constantly. You compromise every moment of every day, you know, unless you're James Cameron, you know, or unless, you know, you're Ridley Scott or Steven Spielberg. And even they have to compromise to a certain extent. But, you know, if we only got a half page today, that's fine. Like, that's not the world we come from at all. But it's always compromise. Like every like you just said, like there's some wonders in there. Didn't plan on it. Just needed to get a shot. You know, and did you have like a ton of storyboards and shot lists? And then the first AD's like, yeah, that's not going to work. I do that all the time. I'd love scaring the hell out of my first ADs.
Oh my God. Yeah. I send them like two pages worth of stuff.
Of shot lists. And they're like, and that's before lunch? Alex, I'm like, nah, I'm just messing with you, man. But do you agree? I mean, it's just constant compromise.
Yeah. I would say for me it wasn't compromised because I didn't lose anything that I wanted.
But you have to adjust.
So adjustments, definitely creative adjustments to get the same. But sometimes it worked out better, man. Like those wonders sometimes are just, and they always do. And that's where I think the crew really came in handy because we had the same crew as like, sorry to bother you, Fruitvale Station. Like it's the same crew in San Francisco. And this is not their first rodeo moving around every 5 seconds. So they were very helpful in terms of being like, okay, but we should try it this way. Not creatively, but being like, all right, we can do this like Dolores Park. Dolores Park was hell. It was hell to shoot in Dolores Park because it's like surrounded by these million-dollar homes that at the time in the 70s were like places nobody wanted to live. So all of a sudden we're trying to shoot a film, about old Mission Dolores in Tech Mission.
Right, exactly. And now it's, you know, my family and I went to San Francisco the other day, earlier this year. And I was just, we're walking around over by the Presidio and we were just checking out real estate prices just for fun. And we're like, how much is that house? How much what? Like, it's insane. But yeah, but like, it's like, you know, you could have bought beachfront property. You could like on Santa Monica in the 70s, it was nothing. It cost nothing.
Yeah, it costs nothing. It cost, well, you could and you couldn't, right? Like the point of the film is that certain people could and certain people couldn't. And as much as the film is about women's rights and as much as the film is about intersectionality of races, it's also a film about financial literacy and wealth, because so many of the times we're talking about these things, but we're not talking about how flawed the bootstrap mentality really is, because not everybody has the same access to anything. Like, you banks were told, do not give loans or credit to XYZ people. They were told that. And even to this day, like, I'm a female entrepreneur. My interest rates are always higher. Like, when I bought my house, I had my fiance stand in front of the appraiser because he's British and he's white. Like, these are just real things that still affect us, and then generationally still affect us. So even me as a filmmaker, my ability to make this film happen because I had a little bit of generational wealth because of what my mother went through. But so many times people don't have that, and they can't enter this market because they don't have that support. Like, to be in Hollywood, you have to be kind of wealthy.
To live in LA.
To live in LA and also to be able to work for no money for 10 years. Like, that's not something that is available to a ton of people. That's, like, not available. You know, and that's why I think this story was so important for me to tell, because, like, yeah, I'm here, but I'm here because of the sacrifices that my mother had to make. And that's, you know, I don't know. I always think about how many filmmakers and how many creators and how many stories are we not getting because someone just can't afford to do that. And that really bothers me, especially when there's nothing but wealth in the industry and it doesn't take much to give someone a little bit of a hand up, that they will do a bunch of stuff with very little. You know, I've been the beneficiary of a ton of pitches and organizations, and they're all great in a long way, but it also feels a little Hunger Game-y, right? Like, you're standing in front of the biggest like group, like corporations in America, asking for this much to tell one story that should be one of millions, and you're standing there and it's a lottery, and it just feels very
Squid Gamey.
It feels very squid gamey, and it doesn't need to be that way,
right?
Yeah, anyways, we could go on and on about that.
No, but you're absolutely right. I think I've never actually looked at it like that, as far as the Hunger Games, Squid Game-y kind of vibe. But you're absolutely right, because when you're going up, you know, when you're talking to these big corporations, or you're talking to the big grant people or big film festivals, I mean, look, if Sundance isn't, you know, the Hunger Games, I don't know what is. I mean, seriously, you got, what, 20,000 submissions and, you know, 110 get picked. Between shorts and features, and South By is not too far behind that. So to get there is pretty remarkable. And the odds are just so against what you're doing, but you gotta kind of love what you're doing. It's like, I call it the beautiful infection, which is filmmaking. When you get infected, you're done. You can't get rid of it as much as you might want to. You know, was there ever, I mean, you did talk a little bit about a moment where you're like, maybe I'm just not good enough. Maybe I just can't go on anymore. I've had that conversation multiple times in my life. I've tried to quit. I've tried to leave. But there's always that voice in the head just says, like, well, what are you going to do? Get a real job? So those moments, I mean, was it just that time, or did you have other moments that you were just like, I don't think I'm going to keep doing this. This is just too hard. I mean, honestly. I
had that moment last week.
That's
pretty much what I was like, so are we going to keep doing this? I'm not having this conversation with you again.
And that's, and you know,
he just starts to tune me out.
You know, and the funny thing is that in so many people's eyes out there, as far as filmmakers are concerned, and screenwriters for that as well, you know, you've succeeded, you've arrived. Because you have a very well respected film. It got up on HBO Max. Like, you're living the dream. But there is a reality behind that filmmakers need to understand. I'm like, that's not the end of the story. That's now the beginning. And you still got to knock on doors. You still got to hustle. You still got to, you know, got to get. And that's when you just said that, like, yeah, I just had that conversation with myself last week. It's true. And I've seen Oscar winners have that conversation with themselves, because it doesn't get any easier. The game, the rules might change, but it doesn't seem to get any easier, even for the biggest. I mean, look, Scorsese was having a problem getting financed. If it wasn't, do you think Irishman would get made if it wasn't for Netflix? Like, no. You know, so it's always like, yeah. But what do you agree with that?
With it always being hard, no matter what. Yeah, it's levels, right? I think it seems like it's levels. Like, what's the next level? And there's always a new challenge at this level. And
right,
it's given me a lot of empathy for people who have been in the industry for a long time, because it's nobody is a bad person.
Right.
Nobody is. You know, again, back to like, there's no real villain. Like, it doesn't seem like there's a villain in the room or anything like that. It's just everyone's doing the best that they can with really, really tough situations. And I want to be the type of team player that comes into a room and says, okay, I see how you've gotten to X, Y, and Z. Like, can I help get to Z plus? You know, like,
right.
Playing within that industry is really important to me. Like, not demonizing anybody, and everyone, I do think everyone's doing the best that they can with
right.
really, really tough odds, for sure.
Yeah, no question. Now I have to ask you, how did your beautiful film find its way to HBO Max? Because that's one of those dreams, those golden tickets. It's, you know, it's up there, you know, Netflix, and you know, it's, how did you get that?
We had a fantastic sales agent. We had a lot of, like, honestly, I always say that the HBO Max of it all was a group win. And when I say group, I mean definitely the people who worked on the film, but a group win in terms of the festivals. Festivals got behind this movie so hard. Like, the lack of support that I felt making the movie, just gone as soon as the movie was out there. It was like, the festivals have been the champions from day, like, they just have completely blown it out of the water in terms of how much they've rallied behind me, behind the cast, behind the story. So it's definitely their win as much as it is mine, because they really, like, started hitting the gong, like, hey guys, we got to pay attention to this. And that really restored my faith in the industry, in a lot of ways, starting obviously with, Janet out of South By, and then all the way to La Leaf, to Mill Valley, even now recently. Mill Valley is an awards festival. It's not something that, you know, smaller films get into, but they opened their doors to us and they were like, no, this is, we hear what happened, like, here you go. And so that was really, really great. And we had a fantastic sales agent who came on and was like, this is going to need the support that you didn't have going into this, so we're going to support it now. And they, you know, they knocked on the door and they held their ground. I think a lot of the times it seems like what I'm learning is, and what I had felt prior to this is, because it's so different from the mold, and like, I, you know, me of being who I am is just a little bit different. The team that you get around you has to understand that. And they have to understand that if you're getting the no, it's not because of the work, it's because of those subconscious things that we're all dealing with. So having a team that's going to stand their ground is the difference between getting HBO Max and not getting HBO Max, I think. And then also, I just have to really give it to HBO Max, because they're bold, they're smart. You know, they were very involved from the beginning of like, okay, this is how we're going to position this. This is how this is, you know, and just to have like this huge corporation, like, come to you and say, we like this. This is part of, you know, where our platform is going and what we, the types of stories that we want to champion and be there for. Like, that was so humbling. And they have an amazing organization going on over there. It's just a very well-oiled machine. And, they really put their money where their mouth is what it sounds is like, what was my experience. So I'm really happy to be working with them, and we'll do it again in a heartbeat.
That's awesome. I'm going to ask you a few questions to ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Stand on the shoulders of your giants.
Ooh, great. I like that. Can you elaborate?
Depending on who you are and what your background is, there are people who have already facilitated the wheel based on your background. Follow them. So I love Steven Spielberg. I think he's one of, you know, he's the best, like, he's, if my God, you know, like, he's an idol of mine, but my trajectory is different than his, and it's just going to be because of the world that we live in. So look for people who have done what you're doing in the lane that you're doing it in. So I had the benefit of watching Chloe work, you know, of watching people go from their small indie movie to their bigger mid-level movie to their Marvel movie. Like, I've had that benefit of seeing that trajectory. So when I say stand on your giants, is...
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Stand on someone whose story sort of mimics yours, because otherwise you're just always going to feel like you're not good enough, because, well, they did it, how come I can't? Well, they're different. They're different because they have a different path, and they have a different path based on socioeconomics or sociology, really.
And also time period. I mean, what worked for Steven Spielberg in the late 60s, early 70s will not work for somebody today, because those opportunities aren't open. Those doors aren't open. There's much more competition. Same thing for like Robert Rodriguez and the $7,000 mariachi. Like, that, you show up with a $7,000 mariachi today, I'm not sure anyone really notices. It's harder. It's much, much harder in today's world. So you have to kind of, now the ways in, it could be like, oh, you've got a podcast, or you've got on, you're big on YouTube, or you are coming through commercials. There's other ways to get in, but it's that field is moving every day, and it's constantly shifting. And right place, right time, right product, they always say.
Right place, right time, right product. Yeah.
Yes. Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
Damn, these are good questions, Alex. Sorry, I don't have a great damn. to negotiate.
Okay.
To negotiate. I learned that there's always more money.
There always is.
It did. Well, you grow up poor, you're just happy to get anything.
You're absolutely right.
You get into a room, and even if there is an abundant amount of money to be made, because you don't have the tools to know that, you negotiate against yourself, right? Nope, there's my husband. Do you have the tools to negotiate? Being able to walk away, being able to know your worth, asking for a little bit more, asking for something that makes it worthwhile for you. Also, obviously, don't take advantage, but yeah, negotiating was something that I really struggled with. So I started getting good at it. I would go to the grocery store, I'd ask for a 10% discount just for fun. And 9 out of 10 times, I get it. That's the crazy part. 9 out of 10 times, I get it. It's weird. So try this. Go to any store, retail store, whatever. Get to the checkout stand and ask for a 10% discount. And then if they say no, ask again. And then they say no, ask again. Most of the time you're going to get it. It's crazy. So I had to learn that. I had to learn how to not take food out of my own mouth by trying to be nice, or trying to be, you know, an inconvenience for someone. Because it's weird. Like, people can smell that crap on you. They can smell, they sniff it out.
What? It's the programming that we were raised with. And it's the same thing. I've always told people, I'm like, you know, have you ever met someone who is very well off, but they're absolute morons? And you're like, how in God's green earth are they how are they successful? And they're just, that you could just tell but they were raised in an environment where a lot of these things, these kind of ideas and things that, you know, let's say wealthy people are raised with, like, they know what a trust is. They know how to build generational wealth. They know how to do, because it's just ingrained in their way. The same way, you know, maybe you and I's parents were like, we know how to stretch a dollar. We know how to, there's lack of this, and there's those, it's just a completely different mentality. And I've struggled with it all my life, dealing with that kind of programming, you know, like, oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I'm just going to agree with you. Absolutely huge. It's programming, right? And on my end, I had two programmings. I had the female programming and the Latino programming, where it's like, as a kid that grows up Latino, you walk into a house, you don't even ask for a glass of water, because that's a sign of respect. Now you get into a negotiation table, you don't ask for a glass of water. They think you're not worth anything. They think that you don't think you're valuable enough. You got to ask for the glass of water. So it's unprogramming sort of that. And then as women too, it's like, you know, stay small, stay malleable. You know, don't be seen as challenging. Don't be seen as difficult. Don't be seen as whatever, right? So there's always that room of being the caretaker that you kind of adopt and gain out of that isn't really, I'm not great at it yet, but learning to negotiate.
Great answer.
It's
something, yeah. and I'm really hope that everyone listening out there picks up a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about in this conversation, because it's stuff that they do not teach you anywhere in any school, and it's stuff that is so valuable. And yeah, sure, it's nice to know what the lenses are, and sure, it's nice to know what the new cameras are, and it's nice to know how to work with the actors, and that's all great, but these little things are what help you build a career, and break through a lot of the barriers that you're going to run into. And there's enough barriers out there without you throwing more in front of yourself.
Seriously. But actors, the lenses, that's a given. So many times I listen to the, you know, filmmakers and stuff like that, and it's like, it's great. Yeah, I know, like Arri Alexa, fantastic camera, performance, you know, read the David Mamet book, totally get it. But like, the politics. Tell me about the politics, because that's what it's going to take.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And last question, three of your favorite films of all time.
Life is Beautiful, for sure. Mm-hmm. Forrest Gump would be my other one. I have so many. I was like, I'm trying to think like different types. I really like Meet Joe Black. People don't like that movie. I love it. I think it's great. I just think that's a great movie.
I do enjoy. I just watched it. Believe it or not, during the pandemic, I watched it with my wife, and I understand it's slow. It's a slow burn. It's a slow burn, but it's beautiful. And Brad Pitt was phenomenal in it. Just phenomenal.
The acting is great. The acting is fantastic. And also, like, it's not a biopic. How do you play death? Like, it's not like he could go and ask death. You know what I mean? So, like, you really had to make choices. And, like, Anthony Hopkins, how do you speak to death? I don't know. Has anybody ever done that before? Probably not. So, like, when I say the acting is good, it's like, yeah, because they had to really just act. That's not like they had source material for that stuff. And that's really interesting. I don't think people give them enough credit for what they did with that. So yeah, anyways, those are definitely one on my top three. I have a long list, but there's definitely some on my top three.
And then where can people see your wonderful film?
HBO Max, baby. For a while, it was sitting right next to Dune, which was the craziest thing ever for me. I was like, that's nuts. That's nuts. And they told me they were going to do that. And I was like, you guys, I'm telling you, like, HBO Max really got behind it. They were amazing. They were like, no, don't worry. The people are going to know it's here. And, you know, and
both movies have about the same budget. So it's only.
Oh, yeah. Same budget. Total same budget. Absolutely. Both world building. Like, this is nuts. But there you go. Like that level of commitment to content, regardless of where it came from, is amazing. Mm-hmm. And I really got to give it up to them as partners. But yeah, so you can watch on HBO Max. We're also doing a couple of screenings out in LA. You can go to at Official Women as Losers on Instagram. That's where we post most of, like, if you want to come see the cast, you want to come talk to us in person. We're all very open to talking, especially Lorenza and Chrissy and Brian and Simo. Everybody, we've all just been so overwhelmed and so grateful for the love and support that we've gotten from everybody. Like, truly. Truly, 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 truly. Like, I could not say gratitude enough, because we'd made this with no expectations. We made it in our backyard. And to see people show up for it has just been like, I think it renewed a lot of our faith in the industry and humanity too. It's pretty good. Like, everyone's really like, oh, wow. Okay. It was kind of like that push. We're all kind of at our wits' end when we made the movie. We're like, this is... We'd just gone through so much individually as people, and then put that into this film, and then to see it on the other hand has been just wonderful. So, yeah.
Lisette, it has been a pleasure talking to you. I wish you nothing but continued success. Thank you for making this film. Thank you for putting this out there. And again, I wish you nothing but continued success in your career. So when you do your next big Marvel movie, please come back.
Thank you. I will. Oh, thank you so much. And I apologize again for all of the family chaos, but such is life at this stage.
I want to thank Lisette so much for coming on the show and dropping her knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, Lisette. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/160. And if you haven't already, please head over to screenwritingpodcast.com, subscribe, and leave a good review for the show. It really helps us out a lot. Thank you again so much for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing, no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.